Before we dive in, two things. First, thank you. Listeners like you are why we do this. Our team works hard on every episode to ensure we bring you the best content possible. Second, it's a gift-giving time of year. People ask us all the time, what's your setup or what's your favorite gear? We put all of our favorites together in our new Generation Leader gift guide. Find recommendations for those hard to buy for people on your list and get them something great this year. Find the gift guide at newgenerationleader.fm/gift and we'll keep this up to date all year round. All right, let's get on with the show.
New Generation Leader.
Human trafficking is one of the hardest issues facing our world today. It's challenging, it's heartbreaking, and the details of what survivors are going through will truly eat at your core. But today on the New Generation Leader, we're talking to Brittany Dunn, the Chief Operating Officer at Safe House Project, an organization that's going to give you hope about this issue, give you the tools that you need to lead and respond to this, whether you are a teacher, an educator, a healthcare worker, or a citizen, there is a way that you can help respond. Brittany's family is deeply entwined in the military, their military background, her background leading this organization. She has so many life lessons and wisdom to share for any leader, but I hope that you find hope as we talk about trafficking in the U.S., how big the issue is, how you can respond, and how you can lead and build trust every day. Welcome, Brittany.
Welcome to the New Generation Leader Podcast. We're giving you the tools you need to lead in the digital world. Ready to reach your true potential? This is the New Generation Leader Podcast.
So, Brittany, talk to me a little bit about the beginning of your journey with Safe House Project, how you got into the organization and into your role.
Well, I will tell you that the greatest parts of my life have been those that I can't plan. And like all things, that is the beginning of Safe House Project. My co-founders and I really came together under a common heartbeat to see child trafficking eradicated in the United States. But to be honest, we had no idea how large the problem was. So when we started, we had no idea who was out there doing what parts of the work. And so it really was just one of those moments where you realize that what you tolerate, you give permission to exist. And so we stepped in not knowing fully what we were going to do or how we were going to do it, but we knew we had to do something. And so when we launched, I was on maternity leave from corporate America. I'd been in mergers and acquisitions for over a decade and really thought that I was going back at end of maternity leave to do that job. But we had three of us, three deployed spouses, and seven children under the age of seven. And so, of course, the best time to start something new is when you have all of these other irons in the fire. It was a catalytic moment, and we never looked back after that. We really found that it was part of our passion and our calling to respond to this issue and be part of the solution.
All right, we'll come back to the mission of Safe House, but I want to take the leadership experience angle there for a minute of the cumulative stress that you and your co-founders had. I talk about this with students in college courses I teach. It's such a pivotal part of understanding, managing stress, working through that. How do three co-founders build something as successful as what Safe House has become when you're starting with that foundation and the busyness and we'll call it chaos of
it was chaos
that much going on in your personal lives? How did you, the three of you, find balance to give enough to get Safe House off the ground?
I think that the key was that there were three of us. And so we were really like a cord of three strands coming together. And so when one of us was at our weakest, the other people stepped into those gaps and could be the strength. And so it was never something that we had to do in and of our own kind of volition, but it was rather an opportunity to be vulnerable when you needed help, to be authentic with one another, and to really build trust. And so I would say that at the end of the day, the organization was built on a foundation of trusting those around us to lead when maybe you couldn't. And so I feel like looking back, I don't remember that first year very much. I mean, having a newborn is already exhausting as it is, and sleep deprivation is real. And so, and I also had a 2-year-old running around, but the most beautiful moments were my co-founders holding my kids and helping just step in on dinners and all these other pieces. And so where I was more of the business mind and our CEO is more of the sales and marketing lens, we would kind of, she would step in and help with kids so that I could sit and write a business plan. And so we always try to recognize each other's strengths and allow each other to operate in our strengths. And then you kind of pull the next person in at the moment in which you are no longer kind of the preferred leader in that moment.
That really is a good snapshot of the power and importance of trust. So many people talk about trust, but I don't think there's often a good explanation or understanding of what that truly means until you're in the moment, like the three of you were. And we talk about it being a foundational element of teams, organizations that function at a high level. You have to have trust. If the three of you had been territorial or trying to work in your silos and prove it to each other, that it wouldn't have worked as well. So a good lesson for all of us in trust. And as you said, the shared collaborative power of working together. What kind of background did the three of you have together? Were you lifelong friends with a deep history together?
You would think. You would really think that that's where you would launch from. I had never met one of the co-founders until we launched. And the other one I had been in a Bible study with and then had had to dinner twice. So no, there was no relationship in any real way before we stepped into this, but we all had a similar vision. And when you have that overarching vision that you all feel compelled to drive toward, it removes you from that position that it's about you and what you can do. And it kind of unifies you under that common mission. And you need that. I mean, every day as military families, we entrust our spouses to service. And part of that is that they are under the same banner when they go out and operate. And so we really, we took a lot of the military principles and leadership principles that we've seen over the years in so many ways, and we just translated that to a domestic problem. And then through that, the relationships really grew together. And they're some of the most influential people in my life and in my children's life. And we operate, we call it the Safe House Project family more than we call it anything else.
It's great when work becomes that strong bond and more than just work and getting things done, but family and collaboration. So it's interesting you talk about the military, because in last week's episode, we talked to Coach Tim Taylor at Navy in the women's basketball program, and he was talking about the life of service and the foundation that the Academy is building in not just their players, but in his context, we talked about those players. So what would you say are some of the keys that the three of you brought into leading Safe House Project that came from what you saw in your collective military experience?
I think that extreme ownership is extremely important. Everybody needs to feel called to put their best out there and sacrifice some level for the growth and expansion of a mission. There were moments where you didn't totally know what the next step needed to be or how you were going to get there, but we all dived our feet in and really understood that we had to figure out our way through. And that grit and that determination and that resilience is so key to that extreme ownership, because if you don't feel like you're part owner in the outcomes, then you're not going to do the work with the same level of passion and determination that you would otherwise. And so even as we've grown our team and it's expanded far outside the original three of us, it's something that we look for. And so we really work to cultivate a cross-functional team that knows how to do each other's parts of each other's jobs or roles. If somebody goes out on holiday or is sick or something happens and we need to fill that area of responsibility. So building cross-functional teams has been really important for us, but also that extreme ownership. And so we really encourage people to fail fast and fail forward. We never want somebody to say, well, I wasn't allowed to do that. Let's go out there and see. And yes, we have made our fair share of mistakes. We have done things wrong. There are areas where you go, oh, those were a lot bigger mistakes than I wanted those to be. But all of those learnings have gotten us so much further faster than anything else would have. And so I think that's been really important, is also embedding that extreme ownership into all of our employees, regardless of their position and role. So I'd say that's key. The other part of it is that it is that resilience. We work on an extremely hard issue. And so when you have to build in resilient people and you have to help them understand vicarious trauma and mental health and all of the complex factors that trafficking survivors are experiencing, you have to do that with a measure of grit and determination. And then you have to meter that with compassion and grace. And so it's really about coming at these core principles, holding both of those and recognizing where self-care is important. Just like in our military, you know, we have service members coming back with PTSD. We have to be attuned to the needs of those who are on the front lines, really fighting against some of the deepest evils in our world. And then you have to meter that with the kind of care and attention that those people that are going out there to do that work need. And so I think that's been a huge value that we've seen as well, is just how do you balance between really pushing and then also giving that time for rest and recuperation.
Yeah, balance, rhythm, calibration, those three words, I alternate between how I describe it. But the reality is, in any factor, any area of our world, we've got to find that balance, rhythm, calibrating all of those components. But I think that's so important in the work you're doing and being able to give. We use the analogy a lot of being able to give out of an overflowing fountain. And so you got to keep that personal fountain flowing and the extreme ownership at the core of that, recognizing we can keep giving, we can keep learning, and we have to keep learning. And that's part of the failing forward factor, is the lifelong learning process. If we're not making mistakes, then we're not learning. Brian Barley joined us on an episode talking about generosity back on episode 35 and in the startup mentality. And now he's starting his second startup focused on generosity. And he talked a lot about power of those examples and just how much we don't see it from the outside, but it's key to an organization being successful is taking those lessons and learning from them. So I want to flip, though, from learning lessons and failing forward to the success side. As you look back on the journey of Safe House Project to this point, what are the greatest, most satisfying wins that you and the team have experienced?
My goodness, there are so many wins. I mean, we are so grateful. We have, I think part of leadership is also leaning into making the big asks and not being afraid of the no. So that has been kind of where we've led from, is that at the end of the day, somebody might say no, but if you're not asking on behalf of those that you serve, then you're going to miss opportunities to make sure that those services continue into the future. And so we're so grateful, of course, for all of the donors and sponsors and foundations that have come alongside to make the work possible. But I think if you really want to get down to the successes, they're not in the numbers. I mean, for us, every number has a name and every name has a story. And those are the stories that truly matter. And so when we see survivors take that courageous step and exit out of a trafficking situation or get on an airplane the first time with an unknown destination, all they know is they're headed to a safe house where they're being told people are going to love and support them and care for them, when all they've known is people who have taken advantage of them and abused them and neglected them. That is such a mental hurdle that they have to get over in that moment. They have to trust that what we're saying to them is completely counter to everything that they know about humanity. And so every time a single survivor chooses to exit, chooses to trust us, chooses to make that brave, brave step, I mean, there's nothing greater. And so there's some of those survivors who I've had an opportunity to walk alongside for a very long time at this point. And so to me, those are my greatest joys. But I also look forward to the one that exited this morning, seeing where, you know, she is in 3 years and 5 years and 10 years and the dreams that she's able to realize as a result of the work.
As I hear you describing it, I hear you talking about the lack of trust that those you're serving and coming alongside of experienced. And even from the beginning, you've countered that within the organization to build that internally. And that is a big gap to overcome, no matter where there is that gap. In any area of our lives, if we have that gap of trust, it's a significant hurdle to overcome.
Human trafficking is happening all around us. Men, women, children, being sold every day in America for someone else's gain. While 88% of trafficking victims access healthcare services while being trafficked, only 1% are ever identified. Do you know how to spot it? Do you know how to report it? Through our healthcare training, survivors and healthcare professionals educate healthcare workers on how to identify and report suspected trafficking. You're the hands of the community, meeting people right where they are, helping and healing. Trafficking victims are waiting for someone like you. You can help eradicate human trafficking. Are you in?
Visit newgenerationleader.fm/hope to start training today.
All right, so looking at Safe House Project from a big picture sense, walk us through the pillars of the work that you all are doing and how you're fighting against this issue.
Yeah, so Safe House Project, we have this audacious goal of eradicating child trafficking in the United States by 2030. And we always get told, well, how are you really going to do that? Well, it is not a statement that we say that's going to be accomplished in our own strength or just by us as a single organization, but rather it is a movement of people who feel compelled to respond to an issue that has really woven itself into the tapestry of our nation. And so when we started, I mean, they estimated at that time through Health and Human Services that 300,000 American kids are trafficked every year, but that victim identification is only at 1%. And so we knew we had to increase that identification rate above that 1% if we were going to be able to effectively move toward that end goal. And so that's our first pillar. We work every day to increase identification by equipping law enforcement, healthcare providers, youth serving organizations, educators, and just really community advocates on how to spot, report, and prevent trafficking where they live, work, and play. This isn't about the hard things that happen behind closed doors as much as it is about really how do we empower people to feel part of that solution. And so we've trained over 270,000 people across the country. And what that has done is increase that survivor identification. And so since the beginning of 2020, we launched our emergency support services line. And we've been able to serve 485 survivors exiting a trafficking situation, getting them connected with victim advocates, working alongside them as they identify a safe house program that they're excited to go to, that they're wanting to restart their life at. And so we've been able to provide transportation and housing and food and clothing to get them to those locations. And then they are there for up to 2 years where they really get to invest in the hard work of healing and therapy and education and life skills training. And so part of the third pillar is continuing to increase safe house capacity around the country. So we help fund, mentor, and certify new or expanding safe house programs that offer that therapeutic care. And so we've added 371 new beds to the national landscape that provide 135,000 safe nights annually. This is key because when we started, there were about 100 beds in the entire United States to serve those estimated 300,000 American kids. And so we really need to continue to push the capacity issue and help make sure that we can connect people into services. And then we come alongside and aggregate data at a national level and really work to then come alongside policymakers to educate them on legislative change, both at the state level and at the federal level, that goes towards the prevention of trafficking, the prosecution of traffickers and buyers, and then the protection of survivors. And so we believe that when we build this infrastructure across the country that really hits on those three core objectives, that then we will be able to move toward that end state of eradication because communities will be empowered to really have that solution at their fingertips.
I don't know if it's because we worked together for a time and I was more aware of the issue, or if it's a both and that there's so much more work happening. Like you said, not just Safe House Project, but other organizations and leaders. But I've started to notice more and more often memos, posters, flyers hanging in airports, train stations, hotels, all over the place, raising or offering the invitation to make all of us more aware of this, the issue, the challenge, and how to see something, say something, and knowing what to look out for. I will say that for me, knowing what to look for came directly from education, from the Safe House Project. So for any listener, what's the opportunity, the invitation that you would give them to learn more about the issue and how they can take a first step?
Absolutely. So we have a lot of different resources depending on, you know, where you're coming from. But our most basic one is OnWatch. It's available at iam, onwatch.org. And that is just a free 1 hour training. It is 10 modules. You don't even have to do all of them. If you just want to learn about bits and pieces, maybe you're interested just in children being trafficked by family members, or maybe you're interested in, you know, what it looks like within our foster system. So you can kind of break it down and pick and choose what is interesting to you, because it is a hard issue. So step into it lightly, give yourself grace as you learn about it. But it really will open your eyes to different people in our communities and the vulnerabilities that cause them to potentially be trafficked. We also have one that's dedicated to healthcare professionals that provide continuing education credits. And that one is available at training.safehouseproject.org. And that is our Hope Human Trafficking training. And then we also do ones for in-home service providers. So definitely check out the website. We have a lot of great resources. We also have downloadable signage that's been put up, as Aaron mentioned, in restaurants and clinics and across the board, you know, areas. And so when we are able to get that signage out there, increase identification, it really allows us to connect people with those essential services that they need to break those cycles of victimization.
We'll link to all those resources in the show notes at newgenerationleader.com/46. Brittany, healthcare leaders, not only current healthcare leaders, but future healthcare leaders, is an area where I spend a lot of time teaching at the nursing college, teaching leadership there. I have no nursing background whatsoever, and investing in healthcare leaders. So walk us through a little bit more in depth the training that's available for healthcare leaders, and for healthcare leaders who are listening, what that looks like for them to engage within their healthcare system.
Yeah, so we find that 88% of trafficking survivors report intersecting a member of the healthcare community while they are being trafficked. And so there's really a unique opportunity for healthcare providers to build rapport, to identify individuals, and then to offer resources and support. And so the training really does just that. It breaks down what trafficking looks like in different parts of the healthcare network. We find that some hospitals have focused on getting their ED trained, and that's fantastic. I mean, obviously ED and clinics are a great place to start, but survivors are going to intersect a lot of different parts of the healthcare network. We have a lot of survivors who might be coming in through OB or, you know, PEDS, even those who are maybe in radiology. And so throughout the training, you're going to see different stories of different survivors who have helped write the training about their intersection points with different members of the healthcare community. And then it takes their signs and indicators that are present in the clinical setting, and it breaks it down based on psychological, behavioral, physical, and social ways that those indicators come through. And so the goal here is really to open up the aperture of what we believe trafficking looks like, and then what are those recommended protocols for reporting. Of course, if it's a minor, it goes through mandated reporting, but we do have an opportunity to offer adult survivors resources that may empower them to feel free to leave and get out of a situation. And so this training was developed with the Academy of Forensic Nursing, with survivors of trafficking, mental health professionals, and healthcare experts. And so it really is very robust. It can provide up to 2.5 hours of CEs, but it really is an opportunity to make sure that as you start your journey, if you're a nursing student or a healthcare student or interested in the healthcare profession, as well as those who are much more tenured in their journey, the opportunity to really understand a complex and hard issue, but one that you all are uniquely positioned to be some of the greatest advocates for these individuals.
I think in OnWatch and what I saw and learned, some of these signs and signals that seem so benign, but when you recognize what it means and what's happening under the surface, there's such a great opportunity for healthcare leaders, for educators, for any citizen to pay attention, to know the signs and what's going on, and make a difference and truly make an impact. So we talked training. How can people follow along with Safe House Project and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, of course. So we do have our Instagram channel, and then which I recommend over. There's Facebook as well, but I don't feel like everybody's on Facebook as much as they used to be. And then, of course, LinkedIn is also a great option. We do a lot of updates on LinkedIn, but then our website is www.safehouseproject.org. And one of the best ways to be continually updated about our work and about the survivors we get to serve is by joining our mailing list on the site.
Yeah, that's great.
For everybody listening, I hope you will follow along with Safe House Project on social media. Join the mailing list. I learn something every time an email comes out from Safe House Project. And
I do too, actually, because it's fantastic. Our staff is so big that they find all these great nuggets. And I'm always like, oh, that's fantastic. So just know I'm still learning as well. This is a process of continual learning.
Yes, we are all on this journey together. So Brittany, I want to come back to you before we wrap up and close. Looking at your journey from corporate to married to a military officer, have a family, what's your personal leadership journey been like throughout your career?
Great question. My journey has, I feel like every part of it has been with the intention of I needed that tool until much later on. And so sometimes you're learning things now that you go, why am I learning this skill set? Or why is this the thing that I have to do today? And all of those things are never wasted, is what it feels like. And so like I look back, and so when I was in international business development and mergers and acquisitions, going into Southeast Asia and helping do acquisition integration of a company into a larger corporate ecosystem meant that you learned sales, you learned finance, you learned tech, you learned all of it. You learned how to launch products from an alpha and really brainstorming all the way through end user. And I think there were moments where it was like, this feels monotonous, why do I have to understand? But for me, if I didn't have that really expansive understanding of how a corporation needs to run from start to finish, then I think our learning curve would have been a lot steeper when we launched. And so I feel really blessed that we as a team come with so many different lived experiences, that we're coming to the table with so much information and tools and skill sets. And then we're layering over that with the expertise of those who have actually lived their trafficking experience. And so when you merge both of those worlds together, you really get this well-rounded solution that isn't missing the mark, because we're keeping those that we serve in mind with every single thing that we do. And so for us, it's leading from a heart of service and just constantly pushing forward and saying, how do we continue to strive for greater outcomes? How do we never allow where we're at to be good enough? And I think that for, you know, me as a leader, I just never want to get comfortable. I always want to believe that there is a greater purpose or a greater outcome that we can achieve on somebody's behalf, whether that's decreasing that time to care or ensuring that there's greater longevity to their outcomes, or that they are able to achieve financial independence, you know, faster, or whatever their dream might be. And so I think I just try to remind myself that this work is hard, but it is beautiful. And it's in all of the mess that so much beauty has created.
That's really an incredible journey. And I love how you phrased something I talk about a lot and ask almost everybody who comes on the show. And you just took the question right out of my mouth, that your journey, you've learned things along the way to use later. And the way that you've continued to build your personal leadership toolbox, it's certainly evident in the way that Safe House is now working to eradicate.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're leading a coalition of our movement of people.
I think it's incredible to watch how you and the team at Safe House Project are leading a coalition, leading a movement to eradicate this issue. And the way that you're bringing your tools, your leadership to the table, collaborating with each other, building that high trust. And I'm sure the high trust that you have in your team is something that's effusive. It's something people notice. And when a trafficking victim first encounters somebody from Safe House Project, I'm sure it's something that they immediately pick up on and feel, even if they've never felt trust before, that they can have trust with this organization, and it's worth it for them to take that step. And we know it's worth it. And I hope that so many more will have an opportunity to take that step and know that they are worth it. And so thanks. Thanks to you and your family for your investment in this issue, but also your investment in our country and our greater good.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me today.
Make sure you follow along with Safe House Project. We'll link to all of their resources. Make sure you connect and link up with them. Follow along. All that will link on newgenerationleader.com/46. Healthcare leaders, educators, community members, make sure you take that training, any of the training that Safe House Project has available. It's worth it, and you will be able to make a difference alongside them and join their coalition. Thanks, Brittany, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the New Generation Leader podcast. Subscribe today on your podcasting platform. Download the show notes and unlock your true leadership potential at newgenerationleader.fm. Thanks for listening today, and we look forward to seeing you next time on the New Generation Leader podcast.
Thanks again for listening to today's show. Don't forget to check out the New Generation Leader gift guide at newgenerationleader.fm/gift. Thanks to Brian, Jim, Jay, and the team behind the scenes. We'll see you next time on the New Generation Leader podcast.